Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, October 8, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone topic is the new book, Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, our call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very happy today to welcome two panelists. Professor Peter H. Shook is the author of Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. He's also the Simeon E. Baldwin Professor Emeritus of Law at the Yale Law School. And I want to note that a link to the book, Why Government Fails So Often, was provided to you in the notices you received at today's call. It's also available on our website, the Federalist Society's website, so please do feel free to check that out. We're going to proceed in an interview format today. Brian Callanan, he's an associate at King & Spalding, is going to interview Professor Shook for the first portion of our program, but then we are, as always, going to turn to the audience for your questions for our author, so please do be ready with your questions. With that, Brian Callanan, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. And as Dean said, we're pleased to have with us today Peter Shook, who is the author or editor of over a dozen books on subjects ranging from administrative law to immigration and citizenship to social policy. His most recent book, the subject of today's discussion, is Why Government Fails So Often. In the book, he examines the deep recurrent reasons for government failure, most of which he argues are endemic to our system. The book provides a sobering, exhaustively researched exploration of the chronic causes of government failure and the factors that best explain its occasional successes. Professor Shook, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. I thought I'd begin by asking what led you to write this very timely book. It was released at a time of some major headline-making government failures, from the malfunctioning of a $2 billion healthcare.gov website, revelations of gross mismanagement of the Veterans Administration healthcare system, and more recently, the Secret Service's failure to guard the front door of the White House. Did you expect this book to be as timely as it is, and what did you aim to achieve in it?
Well, I think it's always going to be timely because, as I said, and as you just recounted, these problems are structural. They're really deep. They're embedded in our constitutional system, in our political culture, in our institutions, our bureaucracy, and in the routines that government officials follow, and also in some of the characteristics of the American voter. So I thought it would be timely and will always be timely because the usual discourse on government problems is very superficial, both in the sense that it doesn't dig very deeply and also in the sense that it seems to focus on things like political gridlock and this scandal or that scandal without appreciating why these problems are so recurrent. It doesn't matter really whether it's a Democratic administration or a Republican administration. It happens, and it's important for the public to understand why that is. And within the degrees of freedom that we enjoy, which are not all that great given our constraints, we can improve the way the system operates.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you say at the outset of the book that your research is limited formally to domestic policy and implementation by the federal government, but that there are lessons for state and local governments. I suppose one threshold question is, in a book about government failure, how do we measure failure of a government program? This is a subject where I imagine there's room for disagreement. Is the right question whether a program achieves the objectives of its proponents, or do we need to take a broader view of unintended consequences? What approach did you take in this book?
Well, I devoted an entire chapter to that, chapter two, because it's so fundamental to the analysis, which is, what do I mean by success and failure? And essentially, the criterion that I apply, and that most of the analysts who have study particular programs apply, is cost effectiveness. That seems to me a very minimal but extremely powerful criterion. Minimal in the sense that there are other things we would want to know about a program before authorizing it or creating it, and powerful because it turns out to condemn a lot of government policies. Now, there's a good deal of debate over how cost-effectiveness analysis ought to be conducted and how we count and what counts as a cost, what counts as a benefit, and all of that. Which I discussed that, but in the end, and I propose various ways of refining the analysis to meet those inevitable limitations of cost-effectiveness analysis. But in the end, I think there is no competitor. There is simply no other minimal criterion that that we can come up with that gives the public the confidence that it needs that the government is spending its money wisely.
Mm-hmm. And how do federal agencies do in this project of measuring results, measuring their own successes and failures, whether it's of spending programs or of regulatory interventions? Is, you know, in your assessment, is sort of due consideration given to measuring results on the back end?
No, very little of it. Very little of it. It's quite remarkable that as several former budget directors of both parties have indicated, an extraordinarily small percentage of the government's budget is devoted to assessing how the rest of the budget is spent and the effectiveness, the cost effectiveness of that. It's almost done, never done, except when Congress requires it, which it occasionally does, very occasionally does it, or when the GAO or the CBO or an outside think tank or scholar does it. And so the vast majority of government policies are unanalyzed in terms of their effectiveness. And this is really a great, great failure of government and one that I urge very strongly ought to be corrected.
Can it be easily remedied? I mean, do you see opportunities for introducing a sort of more systematic approach to measuring government programs? Would you expect that to sort of encounter institutional resistance? Why hasn't it been done?
Well, there's always institutional resistance for the obvious reason that people don't want their performance assessed, lest they do poorly and be penalized or embarrassed. The remedy is pretty straightforward. We know how to do it. It's done by there's quite a large literature on how cost-effectiveness analysis, which is its close cousin, ought to be conducted, with the understanding of some of its limitations and how those limitations can best be dealt with. So this is not new. It's been going on in a fairly systematic way at the Department of Defense, for example, for 50 years. As I say, there's a very large practical literature devoted to improving it.
Now, the centerpiece of your book is an exploration of characteristics that afflict policymaking and account for a large share of the policy failures that you report. Among them are problematic incentives, irrationality, informational deficiency, inflexibility, lack of credibility by government, by political actors, and mismanagement. You walk through those chronic sources of failure.
If I may just add a couple,
Yes.
Implementation is an enormous obstacle to effective policy, and it's one that's almost totally ignored for good reasons and not so good reasons. Good reasons being that it's very hard to foresee how a policy is going to play out in the real world when it runs through the various levels that stand between the enactment of a policy and its effect on the ground, and the poor reasons are that officials simply don't ask that question very much. Their job is to pass the law, and they leave it to others to figure out how it's going to play out. So implementation's a very large source of poor performance. And then I also have a chapter on the limits of law, by which I mean the inherent limits of law, not the limits of any particular law, but all law creates some very serious constraints on the effectiveness of policy. The simplest way to express that, and there are many such limitations, but one is that law inevitably either oversimplifies the problem that's being addressed because law can't handle that many categories without itself getting very cumbersome and complex, or it regulates in excessive detail and therefore prevents the necessary adaptations to reality. So, as I say, I have a chapter on the inherent limits of law, and there are many others besides the simplicity-complexity trade-off that I discuss. And then I have a chapter on bureaucracy, which is a very serious and worsening problem in our system. But why don't I leave it at that and see if you want to pursue that later on.
Yeah, I'd like to touch on each of those topics. Maybe one way of exploring what you identify as these sort of common causes of failure is by looking at a case study, which your book is full of fascinating case studies. One that is a particularly rich case study in your book is the design and implementation of the Affordable Care Act, which I think may receive more attention in your book than any other regulatory regime. So maybe one way of sort of getting more concrete is to perhaps you could walk through for us, what do you see as the sources of government failure that were on display in the design and implementation of the Affordable Care Act? I know throughout the book you sort of, this is a recurring example.
Well, let me qualify that in the following way. When I finished writing this book, the Affordable Care Act had not yet been implemented, and I was able to make a few quick entries while the book was in galleys. But so I don't have as much to say about the ACA as I would like, or as the importance of the example warrants. But I do anticipate some of the problems, and in this I rely to a considerable extent on the work of analysts in health policy who have studied this very, very closely. And so, but again, I reserve judgment on the ACA and overall judgment until we know more about its functioning. But I think there are some, although it accomplishes some very good things, the costs and the implementation problems are very significant, and they're likely to appear downstream. So one of them has to do with the tendency of the government to regulate in a simple way, over simple way as well as an over complex way. As I mentioned before, when I was discussing the nature of legal regulation, the government has under the ACA. Regulated the characteristics of insurance plans that will qualify for the subsidies, and in doing so, it has rendered those policies much less responsive to consumer desires. Mm-hmm. It's sort of take it or leave it if you want that subsidy, and the decisions that have made in that have been made in defining the insurance package in the law are very restrictive and, in some cases, very costly. So that's an example of the oversimplification. In terms of complexity and incentives, we see that there's just an article in the Times today about the fact that Walmart is dropping its insurance coverage for part-time employees and increasing the employee share for full-time employees, and presumably that reflects the fact that these insurance packages that have been mandated are very costly, worth more, worth less to the employees than they will have to pay, even with the subsidies. And also that these the incentives created in this statute encouraged employers to move workers to part-time status in order to avoid the financial burdens of the law, and to reduce coverage, since the government will pick up the tab if the employer does not. So those are just some examples.
On the subject of incentives, I think one of the most interesting and rich parts of the book is the discussion of the failure to account for moral hazards in designing regulatory interventions, and that is the phenomenon of government interventions that produce more risk taking by relieving private actors of the costs of those risks, or at least taking on some of the costs of those risks. You cite in particular the Dodd-Frank Act and the federal student loan programs. So I wonder if you could talk a bit about the role of moral hazard in federal regulatory policy and the extent to which, you know, federal agencies fail to account for this facet, this potential unintended consequence of regulation.
Well, they not only fail to take account of it, they often create it with their eyes open, because the creation of moral hazard actually can have some advantages to the regulatory regime, even though it creates significant likelihood of loss downstream. So under the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac programs during the run up to the Great Recession, creating moral hazard was an objective of many of the policymakers because they wanted to increase the number of families who could move into their own homes. So that was, you know, that was a sort of a desirable objective, although like many desirable objectives, it can go too far and turn into a grave mistake. So it's important to understand that creating moral hazard is not simply an unanticipated byproduct of policy, but of the incentives that officials often have. And indeed, Barney Frank and many of his colleagues on both sides of the aisle were so eager for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to promote home ownership among low-income people that it was they were constantly pressing the agencies to do this, even where there were danger signals. So
how do you say the response? So Dodd-Frank. So you lay out in the book the role that moral hazards caused by federal housing policy played in precipitating the financial crisis. What's your assessment with respect to Dodd-Frank and what is do you view that as on the whole a remedy for excessive risk taking that was fueled by past government policy as well as private sector behavior, of course.
This is a huge question to which neither I nor anybody else has a comprehensive answer. What I think can be said is that Dodd-Frank has not solved the problem of moral hazard on the part of large institutions, and indeed by designating a group of financial institutions as significant ones, has essentially signaled the market that these institutions will be bailed out if they have to be in the future. Now, you know, there are some precautions in the statute to make that outcome less likely, but nevertheless, those precautions may be insufficient to prevent the kind of outcome that the moral hazard has helped to induce. But I certainly don't have any overall assessment of Dodd-Frank. I think it's such a huge statute, and its tentacles reach out so far that I don't think we begin to understand how it's working. A good example from the Dodd-Frank statute is the Volcker Rule, which I do discuss, the famous Volcker Rule, which runs the statute is fairly short in defining what the Volcker Rule requires in terms of limiting the trading activities of depository insured institutions. Again, a very good goal. That is, if the government is going to have to bail out failed banks with taxpayer money in the case of deposit insurance, it ought to ensure that the institution is not engaging in excessive risk-taking with those funds. So that, you know, the goal is certainly an understandable and admirable one. But the regulation that was drafted to implement Dodd-Frank runs about 1,000 pages, almost 1,000 pages. And very few people in the country understand what it means, except for a few, few banking lawyers. And the regulators were obliged, I think within a month of the issuance of the Volcker Rule, to pull back on it to some extent, because it became clear immediately that the rule was having a very adverse effect on small banks in communities. So the ambition was very, very large, and the kind of subtle response to the problem was totally inadequate to the complexity and the dimension of the problem in that particular example.
One political scientist who you draw on quite a bit, and I know you've collaborated with, is the late great James Q. Wilson, who famously described in his 1967 essay The Bureaucracy Problem. He described the rule of reason, a very simple rule, that government should try to do as few undoable things as possible, that government policymakers need to recognize that some things literally cannot be done or cannot be done well because there's no one available to do them. Who knows how? Do you find, in your research, have you found that sort of basic proposition is something that policymakers, legislators with great regulatory ambitions simply fail to take account of, that sort of inherent limitation?
Yes. I mean, they, like all of us, they're subject to their enthusiasms. And if there's a significant problem out there, they want to try to fix it and take credit for having fixed it. And, of course, their desire to take credit for it means that, in part, they often select the wrong instruments to attempt to solve the problem. And their eagerness to make a big splash in a very obvious way. But that, in some ways, that's a secondary problem. The primary problem to which you alluded was, and to which Wilson alluded, is that government increasingly takes on tasks that it simply cannot perform very well. This is not because there aren't problems out there to be solved. There certainly are problems, but there is a relatively new self-confidence by policymakers in their ability to take on new tasks. And one of Wilson's contributions, which I discuss in the book, was to show that things really have changed over the last 50 years. It used to be the case that the federal government would not enter a particular area unless it was able to overcome a strong default in favor of state and local governments handling it or the private sector handling it. And that has changed. Very dramatically. Now there seems to be a presumption in the other direction, such that the government jumps in first. If you have a moment, I'd just like to read this quote, which captures that very well.
Absolutely.
Quote from James Q. Wilson and John Dulio. He says, they said, the old system had a small agenda. When someone proposed adding a new issue to the public agenda, a major debate often arose over whether it was legitimate for the federal government to take action at all in the matter. For the government to take bold action under this system, the nation usually had to be facing a crisis. Each succeeding crisis left the government bureaucracy somewhat larger than it had been before, but when the crisis ended, the exercise of extraordinary powers ended. The new system, that is the system that's arisen in the last 50 years or so, is characterized by a large policy agenda, the end of the debate over the legitimacy of government action, except in the area of First Amendment freedoms, the diffusion and decentralization of power to Congress, and the multiplication of interest groups. Under the old system, the checks and balances made it difficult for the government to start a new program, and so the government remained relatively small. Under the new system, these checks and balances make it hard to change what the government is already doing, and so the government remains large. I would add to that the fascinating and significant correlation. Whether it's causal or not is a complicated question. I think to some extent it is causal. Correlation between the size of government, the federal government, its ambitions and its reach on the one hand, and on the other hand, the growing public disaffection with the federal government. These two go parallel. And and when I'm asked why the public disaffection has grown so greatly, I say, well, there are a number of possible reasons, but the most obvious parsimonious explanation is that the public has concluded that the government isn't doing a good job, and that it's the taxpayers' money is not being well spent. So, you know, there are lots of complicated possible explanations, but the simplest one is the public realizes that the government is failing far more than it should, and draws the sensible conclusion that it's that the problem is in the way in which government is performing.
And now, the book is not all bad news. You do have a chapter on occasional government successes. And so I guess it would be interesting to ask, what's the lesson that unites what you view as the great successes of the past 50 years by the federal government?
Well, I'd say there are a couple of themes. Several of the great successes involve situations that were relatively simple for the government to design and implement. The Homestead Act of 1862, though, like all programs, had its complications and its difficulties, including fraud and others, was basically a giveaway by the government of vast tracts of land that were empty, except for Native Americans, were empty and unexploited. It was a complicated program to launch, but basically there were no losers in the program. The Morrill Act of 1862, both of these are Lincoln-era successes. The Morrill Act set up the land-grant college system. It's basically giving, the federal government giving land to the states to establish land-grant colleges for the dissemination of agricultural and other scientific education. Some of our greatest institutions today, like Cornell, my alma mater, are land-grant colleges. Then you come to something like Social Security, which I believe is a great success, although it has to confront its looming insolvency in short order. The means of doing that, I think, are fairly straightforward and well within our power and resources. But Social Security is a relatively simple program in which the government basically collects information about people's years of birth and their employment history, and then writes checks. That's not as complicated as the vast majority of programs that have failed. Then we come to the GI Bill, which was a special situation growing out of a crisis in which there's a very strong sentiment on the part of the population that these careers that had been foreshortened by military service needed to be subsidized and through educational opportunities. The interstate highway system was created a lot of jobs, obviously, because of the infrastructural projects that needed to be undertaken, and was a kind of public good that only the government could provide to unite the continental nation, just as we had with the Transcontinental Railroad. Then there are a couple of 1965, the Voting Rights Act, at least as originally implemented, was an extraordinary success, one of the most important in our history. There are downstream problems with the Voting Rights Act, but nevertheless, its success is paramount in our society. But there, that was a system in which the government had to get out of the way, or had to make the states mm-hmm. and localities get out of the way and allow people to exercise the vote. There were certainly complications. There was violence. There were immense obstacles to implementation. But the basic concept of the law was fairly straightforward. People have a right to, you know, blacks have a right to do what whites have been doing for centuries. And the other great success in 1965 was the Immigration Nationality Act, or the basic framework for our immigration system. And again, the government was giving out benefits by creating opportunities for people to come here and eliminating artificial and, in many cases, racist barriers to migration. So
it sounds like none of these successes you've outlined are involve programs that are complex in design or programs that attempt to regulate or change sort of entrenched behavior or private choices.
That's right.
Is that a fair description?
To oversimplify, the bottom line lesson of these successes is that they have not tried to change human nature. What they have tried to do is to change the opportunity structure and eliminate barriers to people pursuing their own goals, such as voting or obtaining education. But they didn't have, they weren't ambitious in terms of changing our character, because government doesn't know how to do that well. Indeed, we don't know how to do that well quite apart from the government. Another example of the success is the Earned Income Tax Credit of 1975, which basically is a check-writing operation by the government in which it supports the working poor, a relatively politically popular group, and has greatly increased the incentives to work. Again, there are problems. There's a lot of fraud in that program, but it's I think by any account has been a very successful one. And then there's airline deregulation. That was has been a great success, but it was deregulation, which is a confession that the regime that had been in place for 40 years had failed very egregiously.
Mm-hmm.
And so on, and you know, there are some others, but we're short on time.
At this point, Dean, I suppose we'll open this up to questions from callers.
Sure thing. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our author today, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have, Brian, one question at this point. Let's go to that first caller.
Yes, my name is Roman Bueller. I'm the director of a group called the Madison Coalition. And one concern about the federal regulatory process is that over the years it has evolved, and I guess I speak as someone who was a committee counsel for Congress for 14 years, from a process of designing regulations that carry out Congress's intent to a process where regulators are now able to stretch or in some cases even ignore congressional intent. And I wonder what your view is of a reform that would require major federal regulations to be approved by Congress before they could go into effect, something like the Arraigns Act that was voted on in Congress, approved by the House of Representatives last year.
Well, that's a great question. I would just let me say a few things before I address it, your question very specifically. The more general observation would be that whether the administration deviates from congressional intent is a very difficult question. It's one that's the subject of great debate in almost every case, and often litigation, as we know. And Congress writes laws in ways that make it fairly easy to argue that its intent has been violated, because the statutes are either very, very specific, in which case maybe there's less debate about what its intent were, or they're very general. They give enormous discretion to the administration, in which case it's hard to say what its intent was. Moving beyond that, you're suggesting a legislative veto. As you know, in the early 1980s, the Supreme Court struck down as unconstitutional in the Chadha case one form of legislative veto, and Congress has been struggling ever since to find a form of legislative veto that would pass constitutional muster and still be effective. I think the best way to address this problem is for Congress to exercise its existing powers of oversight much more energetically than it has before, and to correct errors that either it created or that the administrators created in implementing the statute after the fact. But in the case of very important regulations which ought not to take effect until Congress has had a chance to review them, that's a fairly straightforward thing to remedy, which is that Congress can simply say that the regulations will not take effect until a certain period of time has elapsed in which the Congress has an opportunity to review what the administrators plan to do.
Do you think a constitutional amendment to require that regulations should be approved by Congress would be a good policy change, or do you think it would slow the regulatory process down too much?
Do I think that the Constitution would have to be amended to empower Congress to require administrators to let their regulations lie before Congress before they take effect? No, I don't think. I think that's clearly constitutional, and no amendment would be necessary. And indeed, there are some statutes today that have that characteristic.
Once again, this is Dean Reuter. If you have a question, our lines are wide open right now. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Brian, maybe you'd let me get a question in here if I could. What about sunsetting laws? Are you in favor of those? Some laws have sunsets require reauthorization or re-upping by Congress, or they lapse and others don't. Should that be used as a tool more broadly?
Yes, I discussed that in my chapter on how to make government more effective. That's one of the many suggestions.
Would that apply
one problem,
to all laws, or?
No, I think it ought to be used in a discriminating fashion, because it does impose a significant burden on Congress, and unfortunately the effect of sunsetting can be neutralized by simply passing continuing authorizations and promising to take up the reauthorization question in 6 months or a year and so forth, and then they continue to do so. No Child Left Behind is a good example of that. It was enacted in 2003 or so, or maybe it's 2001, and then it was supposed to be reauthorized in 2007, I believe. I may have the year wrong. And then years went by where Congress kept kicking the can down the road. I'm not sure it's even now been reauthorized. So Sunsetting is not a panacea, but it does focus the mind a bit, and I think help in forcing Congress to revisit what it has wrought.
Brian, it looks like we've got two caller questions at this point pending, a third now. Should we take another question?
Terrific. Yep.
Here we go.
Hi, this is Bill James. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just
yes.
fine. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. All right. Relative to laws and the post-roads restriction and governing is opposing to managed transportation, the town of Secaucus, New Jersey, passed a law in June that says if you can build transportation with private capital, operate it without government subsidies, exceed 120 passenger miles per gallon, and pay them 5% of gross revenues, we can have access to build, and we're going to start building solar-powered transportation networks there. And you can see this under J-PODs, so we're a bunch of ex-military guys. Most of us are West Point guys that studied nuke engineering together. And from our point of view, we've been fighting oil wars since 1990 and done nothing to get off foreign oil. So by having government shift from managing how transportation is conducted to governing what society needs, and I'd like to see what you can think of how you can apply all the stuff that you've written and include this in so that we get academic coverage of this sort of a concept. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I'm not sure I understand enough about what you have in mind to comment terribly specifically, but I do have a section in my chapter on, you know, how to make things better on privatization. Privatization is a like everything else, is a kind of mixed bag. Sometimes it's very effective and saves a lot of money, and the quality of the service or product doesn't decline or may even improve. And sometimes it doesn't work so well, and there's a lot of controversy over where particular services fall on that spectrum. So for prisons, for example, the data that I've read most recently by Malcolm Feely at the University of California at Berkeley is privatization prison size has on the whole been a very successful venture. But there are many who disagree, and it depends on the state and the nature of the prison activity that's being privatized. But privatization is an option that ought to be seriously considered by governments, and I think increasingly is considered because they're scrapped for resources. The kind of private venture that you have in mind sounds very exciting at a very abstract level, because you know, as I say, you have to look at the details, and that's always the case. You know, God is in the details, but that the city of Secaucus is, as I understand from what you said, authorizing the investigation of this possibility is a very, very good thing. I hope I haven't misunderstood your question.
Brian, we've got one caller question pending at this point. If the audience would like to ask a question, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Professor. This is Matthew Rackety. I'm a George Mason law student. Thanks for the great talk. I've recently been looking at Francis Fukuyama's new book on political decay, and I'm struck there's a lot of parallels between what you're saying and what he seems to be saying. I don't know that I fully buy into his analysis, but he seems to hold that institutions are on the decline in the United States and that they're not no longer effective. And it sounds like your book, which I look forward to reading, puts forth a set of particular policies that would do quite a lot to address many of the problems. But my question is to what extent are the institutions really capable of realizing these ends, and what are the sort of the key obstacles to your mind in so doing?
Well, that's a $64 trillion question. I think, let me say a few things. First of all, I haven't read Fukuyama's book, but I know the general argument. And there has been an atrophy of institutions, even as there's been a proliferation of institutions. The atrophy has occurred in the authority that institutions enjoy in the public mind. So many of our most important institutions have become delegitimated to some extent, and that certainly includes the federal government, but it also includes, you know, the Catholic Church and universities and many others. I think we're a much why does has this occurred? It's very hard to say, but I think that we are a much more difficult society to govern today than we were in the past. Part of that is a good thing, which is that people become better educated and more sophisticated, and they're more knowledgeable about the world about them, and they don't defer as readily as they used to the government or religious authority or professors or anybody else. So that kind of skepticism is, I think, a healthy thing, but it does make it much harder for institutions to maintain their authority and to exercise it effectively. The military is one institution that has gained in its legitimacy and its respect, and that's a good thing. But, of course, the military is a very different kind of organization than the ones that we are accustomed to deal with. So I'm not sure how much of a model it is for other things. The military has been very effective in integrating racially and in terms of sexual orientation and religion and so forth. They're a model. They're really a model for implementing some of our most profound social changes. But they have an authority structure that isn't replicable readily in civil society. So it's a big problem. I don't think the downward trajectory of institutional vigor is inevitable, but it's a strong one. It would take a lot to turn it around.
We've got now three questions pending and about 12 minutes left, so please be cognizant of that as you phrase your questions. Let me remind folks that the name of the book we're talking about is Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. Our author we're speaking with today is Peter Schuck, and that book is available at Amazon, and of course a link was provided to you in the notice of today's call. With that, let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, Peter, this is Bill James again. I think the analogy to what we're looking at is the restoration of communications infrastructure to free markets in 1982. And I sent you an email, but I'd like to talk more about this at some point in time. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Professor, did you want to respond, or should we take the next question?
No, take the next one, please.
All right. We've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is George Mann, an attorney in Houston, Texas, and I'd like to hear what the author has to say about a particular problem that I have noticed, and that is federal agencies and commissions forum shopping. I have a particular case in mind with the FTC that brought a action against a national advertiser in the Ninth Circuit, which was a more favorable circuit for their action, and also that an injunction against a actor subject to a regulation can be enjoined without a jury trial in the abuse of the administrative state, not only from avoiding congressional oversight, but choosing which forms laws that they have to follow.
Well, you've mentioned two things. I don't have a great deal to say about them, but let me say something briefly. In terms of forum shopping is a problem when it's performed by the government, and also when it's performed by private parties seeking a more favorable tribunal. There are ways that the law can re- reduce forum shopping, and you know, the statute, for example, can designate where the proceeding will be held, in what district, in what level, and so forth. But I don't. But short of that, I don't see any. And of course, there are doctrines of forum nonconvenience, under which courts can, under unusual circumstances, refuse to entertain a claim because there's a much more suitable forum elsewhere. But short of those sorts of remedies, I don't know what can be done, so long as we're a large country with lots of different fora in which people have plausible claims that the fora have jurisdiction over them, over the dispute. The second one was on, remind me if you will.
I'm not sure. I didn't break it down into two, but it's the regulatory state is circumventing,
I'm sorry. It was jury trial. It was jury trial. Yeah. Well, you know, our Constitution regulates the availability of jury trial, and state constitutions do as well. And that seems to me to be a question that the courts are pretty much able to handle. So determining under which circumstances a jury trial is or is not available, under which circumstances a common law proceeding can be brought rather than, or must be brought rather than, a administrative proceeding. So I don't see any sort of deep structural impediment there.
Okay, I'll disagree on that, but I will look forward to reading your book, which I admit to not having read yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We've got just one question pending. I think we've got time for more than one question. So if you'd like to add yourself to the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yes, thank you. My name is Tim Harker. I'm a Washington lawyer. I wonder if you would comment on the paradox of a society that increasingly turns to government to solve problems in the face of an overwhelming abundance of evidence that the government is incompetent to solve those problems in many ways.
Well, this is a central paradox that my book addresses, and I can't resolve the paradox completely because it's really a question of what the voters, the kinds of officials that voters elect, and so long as they elect officials who are determined to ignore evidence or don't seek evidence concerning what works and what doesn't under what circumstances, we're going to have these problems. So here is, and I alluded to this at the very beginning, here's a situation which the voters, I think, have themselves to blame, and they simply have to be clearer about what their expectations are of their elected officials. I think we have a very, very vibrant political process that we're observing now in the run-up to the elections, and I think the public will be heard. But in the end, the public has to decide that it either will countenance the way in which the federal government is being run, or insist that the new voices have to be heard and changes need to be made.
As a thought about one avenue of solution to the paradox, a few weeks ago, Professor Hamburger discussed his new book about administrative law. Is administrative law unlawful? Do the courts have a role to play in providing a solution here via focusing more tightly on the legality of delegating to administrative agencies?
No, I don't think the court has much of a role to play. The court has, in the past, as you must know, beginning in the 1930s, made a serious effort to restrict the broad delegations of authority that Congress makes, and that didn't go anywhere. And I think the reason it didn't go anywhere is that it's a doctrine that's extremely difficult for courts to implement. It's very difficult for courts to know exactly how much discretion is appropriate for a particular problem, and how much delegation is too much, or whether statutes ought to be written differently. I just don't think the courts are very good at that, except in extreme situations. I think the administrative state will always have a difficulty convincing a public like the United States, like Americans, that it's a legitimate form of governance when it's not elected. But I don't think the courts can really solve that. I think that has to be, like so much else, that has to be remedied in Congress when laws are written.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I want to give Brian Callanan a chance to ask a final question, if you have one, Brian.
Sure, Dean. Just regarding lessons from this book, Professor Shook, I know that sort of the critical reception in some ways has been, your book's been very warmly received by conservatives who sort of in some ways see their own policy preferences or inclinations confirmed by the evidence you marshal here of government's tendency to fail at in grand regulatory programs. For progressives, it's more likely to be somewhat painful reading. I guess the question to you is, what do you hope or expect conservatives should take away from reading this book, and what do you hope and expect that progressives should take away from reading this book?
It's a great question, and it's a painful one in some respects, because the book has received a lot of attention from people in the center and on the right, but very little attention so far, at least, from the left. And I think that's a shame, because there's a lot to be learned by progressives from this book, and I'm not sure whether they simply don't want to learn those lessons, or the book hasn't come to their attention. I just can't say. But to answer your question, I think you're quite right that conservatives are likely to read the book and say, "Yeah, I told you so." Shuck has just provided a lot of evidence to support what I already believe, but I think it's important to understand precisely why it is that government fails, and not simply paint with too broad a brush, and as many conservatives do, and say, "Well, government is the enemy. Government is inevitably the enemy. Can't do anything right." There are better or worse ways to govern, and I think conservatives need to be sensitive to that as well. As I say first chapter, I think big government is here to stay. So conservatives need to understand it better and figure out how to reduce its failure rate. If Ronald Reagan couldn't tame the administrative state, I don't think any Republicans likely to do so. On the progressive side, I think the lesson, I think, is an obvious one, which is government has a propensity to design programs that are extremely difficult to implement and that are going to be ineffective and often not cost-effective. It's simply going to alienate the American public to foist more and more of these programs on them. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly not to progressives' interests, it seems to me, to further discredit the federal government by increasing its failure rate, or even sustaining the failure rate that it's now using.
Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. And before turning it back over to Dean, I just want to thank you, Professor Shook, for this fascinating discussion about a book that, in my humble opinion, should be required reading for all policymakers and lawyers engaged in policymaking. And with that, I will turn it over to Dean.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and let me add my thanks on behalf of the Federal Society to both Professor Peter Shook and to Brian Callanan for your job conducting the interview. I certainly appreciate it. It's a great call. Once again, for our audience, the title of the book is Why Government Fails So Often and How It Can Do Better. I do have an important programming note. I'm handed a note here during this call that tomorrow's Teleforum conference call with FTC Commissioner Maureen Olhausen might well be postponed. So do check back with the Federalist Society's website for updates on on the schedule. Otherwise, our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll be debating the Take Care Clause, the President's duty to enforce the law. But until that next scheduled Teleforum conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.